Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Eric Boehm here, interrupting your Friday afternoon with a special announcement. You might know me from my guest appearances on this here podcast, but I've also got my own Reason podcast. It's called Why We Can't Have Nice Things, and right now we're in the middle of our second season. We've been covering a series of stories about how the government's meddling in American healthcare is making us poorer and sicker. And if you're a fan of free minds and free markets, I think you're going to enjoy it. Just don't forget to take your blood pressure medication first. Now, speaking of prescriptions, the first episode of this new season of Why We Can't Have Nice Things includes an interview with Mark Cuban. And he's talking to us about a new project of his called Cost Plus Drugs, which is aimed at lowering the costs of prescription drugs. As part of that conversation, I learned that a big part of the reason why drugs are so expensive in the United States is because we've made it difficult for basic market functions like prices to work the way they're supposed to. So I'm going to play that episode for you in just a moment, and if you like what you hear, please like and subscribe to Why We Can't Have Nice Things, which you can find at Reason.com or on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. We've got new episodes coming out each Thursday through October 10th. And don't worry, all of your faves from the Reason Roundtable will be right back on this feed next Monday, as usual. Thanks for listening, and I hope to talk to you again soon. What's wrong with American healthcare? We're the richest country on the planet. We live in an age of incredible scientific breakthroughs that mean people live longer, healthier lives. We have the best medical schools, the best physicians, the best tech. But ask someone about their most recent trip to the doctor or the hospital, and you'll probably hear a groan and then a few complaints. So, really, what's wrong here? I'm Eric Boehm, and this is Season 2 of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, a Reason Magazine podcast series. You'll often hear that the problem with American healthcare is, essentially, the profit motive. That drug companies and hospitals and so on are more interested in their bottom lines than in taking care of patients or providing affordable services. Healthcare is a right, people like to say. Healthcare is a public good. Something about that logic has just never quite made sense to me. I mean, any successful business has to balance its bottom line with the needs and wants of its customers. Is healthcare more of a right than food? Yes, you might argue that healthcare is a bit different than some other markets, but I'm not sure that it really is. Everywhere else, free market capitalism encourages innovation and competition. Better products, better services, lower prices tend to win. But healthcare costs keep going up, and almost no one seems to be happy with the services they're getting. In a Gallup poll taken last year, just 10% of Americans said healthcare in the U.S. was excellent. So yeah, what's wrong here? That's the question that was driving me when we launched into the new season of this podcast. And from the start, I felt like we wouldn't find the answer in Washington, D.C., so I spent the past few months talking to some of the people who deal with this stuff every day. Like a midwife in Georgia.
They were interested in blocking us at whatever the cost.
An eye surgeon in North Carolina.
It is a very pernicious law that seems very small and ineffectual on the surface, but that infiltrates every aspect of healthcare.
A cancer specialist in Massachusetts.
Physicians are confused and you know, our ethical obligations are in direct conflict with the law.
And some of the lawyers and activists who are working to improve the healthcare system for patients and doctors. I came away from those conversations with the sense that America's healthcare system is nothing like a free market, and the only capitalism is often of the crony variety, with special interests lobbying for special treatment from the government. So on this new season of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, we're covering a series of stories about how the government is making Americans sicker and poorer. We've dug deep into the laws and regulations that are restricting doctors' ability to treat patients and patients' ability to get needed treatments. And hopefully we'll offer a few solutions to those problems too. In fact, I thought we would kick things off by talking to a guy who is trying to provide one of those solutions. Someone who is trying to inject a little bit of entrepreneurial capitalism into the pharmaceutical drug industry.
My name is Mark Cuban. I'm an investor, an entrepreneur, and co-founder of Cost Plus Drugs.
Now, you know Mark from his long-running TV show Shark Tank, as well as being the co-owner of the NBA's Dallas Mavericks. His latest major venture is Cost Plus Drugs, launched in 2022. It's a website where consumers can buy generic pharmaceutical drugs at transparent prices and get the drugs mailed directly to their door, bypassing the middlemen that are typically involved when dealing with pharmacies and insurance plans.
Drug prices are rising twice as fast as the rate of inflation.
And that has people making some dangerous decisions.
We wouldn't have, you know, filled the prescription for the drug if we had known that we had to pay that exorbitant amount.
The Wilkins are far from alone. 23% of people surveyed by Gallup said they could not afford to fill a prescription drug at least once.
So if you were a contestant on Shark Tank with this idea with cost plus drugs, how would you pitch it? Like, what's the elevator pitch for what it is that you're doing?
The elevator pitch is really simple. Who do you trust within the medical supply chain? Your doctor? Do you think the healthcare system is run properly? Do you trust it at all? And if I could, and if I could show you a business where you could trust it because everything was transparent, would you be more likely to use it? Yes. And if I could show you this business and show that I saved you money on your medications, would you be willing to tell others? Yes. And that's exactly why we have spent a total of in our entire life history of cost plus drugs, zero on marketing and advertising. Because it was really obvious to me that if you were taking imatinib, a cancer drug, and you were paying $800, $1,000, $2,000, and we were selling it for $30, not only would you buy from us, but you tell your doctor and you tell everybody in your Facebook, you know, support group that has the same disease to do the same thing. And that's exactly what's happening.
Cost plus drugs shouldn't seem like a revolutionary thing. It operates the same way that so much of the modern world does. It's consumer friendly, easily accessible, and fast.
You go to costplusdrugs.com, you put in the name of the medication, it tells you where your doctor should send the script, tells you how much it costs, and then boom, we fill it.
We'll talk to Mark a bit more about cost plus drugs and the business model later in this episode, but I want to cut right to the chase here. Obviously, a big part of his sales pitch is lower prices. So that leads to an obvious question, one that comes up quite a bit whenever politicians start talking about healthcare policy. Why are drug prices in America so high?
Drug prices in this country are so high because there is zero transparency in the system. And when there's zero transparency in a market, there is no way for it to be efficient. When it's inefficient, people learn very quickly how to take advantage of those inefficiencies to their own profit. And that's exactly what's happened in the healthcare and pharmacy side.
But cancer diagnosis isn't devastating enough. Many patients simply can't financially afford the fight. A new study finds 1 in 3 Americans on Medicare and who do not qualify for low-income subsidies do not fill prescriptions for their
cancer. So why is the cancer drug that Mark mentioned so expensive? To answer that question, we need a quick review of Econ 101. At the grocery store, for example, food prices are determined by supply and demand. Bananas are cheap because there are more than enough of them for all the banana lovers out there. Filet mignon is more expensive because demand is higher relative to supply. In the case of cancer drugs, you can throw all of that out the window. Maybe the most famous example of how drug pricing is just insane involves another name that you've probably heard before, a guy who, as it turns out, actually played an indirect role in Mark Cuban's idea to create cost plus drugs.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it pronounced Shkreli?
Yes, sir.
See, there you can answer some questions. That one didn't incriminate you.
Today, this office and the FBI are announcing the arrests this morning of Martin Shkreli.
Turn now to who many are calling the most hated man in America, the drug company executive who became notorious for jacking up the price of a life-saving drug by more than 5,000%. He is now
yes,
free on
Martin Shkreli, aka the Pharma Bro. Shkreli started off as a Wall Street wunderkind. He was working at a hedge fund when he was just 17, and he would later launch two of his own. Both of those failed, but in 2015, he founded a pharmaceutical company, Turing Pharmaceuticals. And then he made two purchases in 2015 that would make him famous outside of Wall Street. The first thing Martin Shkreli did is buy the one and only copy of the Wu-Tang Clan album Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. It cost him $2 million. On the crime side, the New York Times side, staying alive was no job, had second hands,
moms bounced on old men, so then we moved to Shaolin land. What kind of vibe did you get off the guy when you met him?
So he heard the 12 minutes and he just really enjoyed the music. I couldn't measure if he was a guy in college, you know what I mean? Couldn't get it. You know?
The other thing he bought in 2015 was Daraprim, an anti-parasite drug developed in the 1950s and used to treat malaria. Now, more recently, Daraprim had been used as a way to treat patients suffering from the side effects of AIDS. But when Turing Pharmaceuticals bought Daraprim, Shkreli hiked the price of the drug from $13.50 to $750 per pill.
He increased the price of a drug used to help people with AIDS and cancer by more than 5,000%. Donald Trump called him a spoiled brat.
Now, you guys have said that the reason you increased this price so much after acquiring the drug was in order to do the research and development to develop a better version of Daraprim. I just got off the phone with an HIV doctor who told me they don't need a better version of this drug. What are you doing here?
Yeah, that's not true. At this price, Daraprim is still actually on the low end of what orphan drugs cost, and we're certainly not the first company to raise drug prices.
There are a whole bunch of reasons why he was able to do this. Daraprim wasn't under patent anymore, but no generic version of the drug existed, so there wasn't any competition. And the process for developing a new generic drug and getting it approved by the FDA is long and complicated. So there wasn't going to be any competition in the near future. By the way, the FDA approval process for new and generic drugs, that's a whole other reason why we can't have nice things, and we'll talk about that in another episode later this season. For now, what matters is simply that Shkreli did this, that he hiked the price by a lot. And it's not like $750 per pill was a market-determined price, the result of supply and demand. It was totally arbitrary. But it did one other thing. It sparked a conversation that Mark Cuban had a few years later.
I got a cold email from a Dr. Alex Oshmyansky, and he said he had a compounding pharmacy in Denver, Colorado that was going to make drugs that were generic drugs that were in short supply. And so we started talking, and I'm like, you're thinking too small. And then for whatever reason, our conversation turned to the farmer bro, Martin Shkreli. And I was asking him, I'm like, look, how can this guy basically buy this drug and just jack up the price? And I asked another question. I'm like, what would it cost just to buy the entire production of whoever makes Daraprim and give it away for free? And first thing he said was, well, you're not allowed to buy it and give it away for free. Second thing he said was, it'd only be about $250,000. I'm like, wait, for the entire year's supply, it'd be about $250,000. And he was like, yeah. But whoever makes it has locked it, Shkreli locked it up, so it's not available to anybody else. And that was why he was able to do this. And I was like, that just tells me this is a very inefficient market. There is something wrong here. The question is what? And so I started digging in, and it didn't take long for the what to become very obvious, and that is a lack of transparency. And when you think about it, when you get that prescription to go to a pharmacy, you know, think of the process for all of us who have gotten prescriptions. Hey, Mark, you need da-da-da-da-da. What pharmacy do you use? That's it, right? There's no discussion of cost. There's no discussion of anything else.
What you pay for prescriptions is the result of whatever prescription benefit your insurance offers. That price can be very different from what the drug manufacturer charges its distributor, or what the distributor charges the pharmacy, or what the pharmacy charges your insurance plan. It's complicated. For a lot of Americans, those prices are a source of economic hardship. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, about 1 in 5 adults say that they have not filled a prescription because of the cost. And 1 in 10 adults say that they have cut pills in half or skipped doses of medicine in the past year because of the costs. But if you're getting prescriptions in the typical way, that is, going through insurance and using a traditional pharmacy, you likely don't have any idea what they cost. That's where Mark says that cost plus drugs has made a difference.
And so I was like, okay, Alex, here's an opportunity for us, and let's see what happens. Let's create a website. Can we, you know, is there a URL available, cost plus drugs or something? And boom, we were able to get costplusdrugs.com. And so we set out to do this, and the underlying policy was we were going to show you our cost. We are going to show you our markup. We are going to show you what we charge for a pharmacy fee and for shipping, so you'd know not only what you were paying for any medication you bought through us, but you would know why you were paying that amount and you would know what it cost us.
There's such a lack of, I mean, and you touched on this already, but there is such a lack of transparency in just about everything to do with healthcare, particularly with drugs. Like the ability to just put that information out there seems like it should change the way other people behave too in this marketplace. Is that, are you seeing any of that yet?
100%. So the smartest thing we did without actually realizing it was going to be so smart was publish our price list. Because if there was no transparency on pricing, and the people who typically set the pricing, the pharmacy benefit managers, do everything possible to eliminate transparency with their contracts. Well, when we published the price list of what started as 100 plus drugs and now is, you know, 2,500 medications, now all of a sudden there was a benchmark that everybody could compare not only their own pricing, personal or if they're a self-insured employer, but also for Medicare and Medicaid, right? To compare what the government is paying.
Again, healthcare is a little bit different than other markets, but you can basically think of Cost Plus Drugs as an outlet mall for prescriptions. It lets consumers buy direct from manufacturers, or at least more directly from manufacturers, without going through all the middlemen. Those middlemen are the insurance companies and the pharmacy benefit managers, or the PBMs, which Mark just mentioned. By doing that, there are potentially big savings to be realized. A Vanderbilt University medical study published last year found that the U.S. government could save taxpayers between $228 million and $2.15 billion a year if insurers operating in the Medicare prescription drug plans purchased 7 generic oncology drugs at the prices obtained by Cost Plus Drugs. So, why aren't more people doing this?
The problem is the lack of transparency. Because if there's no transparency, then they can charge you whatever they want, and you don't know if you're being overcharged or not. And it's not just about what they charge you for medications. They charge you all these fees. But who would you rather have making the decision on what medications you have access to, Eric? Your doctor or your PBM? And even if it's not a matter of which medication is best for you, often there may be a generic and the PBM doesn't get a rebate on the generic. So they'll make you prescribe the brand medication that they get a 60% rebate that ends up costing you, you know, $1,000 when you could have bought it for $50 from us, right?
I realize that we're getting pretty deep in the weeds now. So let's pull back for just a moment. Regardless of whether you have private insurance or a government-run plan like Medicare or Medicaid, you've actually got two different kinds of health insurance. One covers doctors and direct care like treatment at a hospital, and the second covers prescription drugs. Pharmacy benefit managers, the PBMs, they manage the list of drugs that are available through certain insurance plans. That list is known as the formulary. In theory, they have negotiating power that an individual simply wouldn't. They're supposed to be able to drive down the prices that manufacturers can charge.
They create formularies, which allows them to play pharmaceutical companies against one another in order to get a lower price. And then they either get lower prices directly or more commonly, they get rebates.
This is David Hyman, a professor at Georgetown University and the co-author of several books, including Overcharged, Why Americans Pay Too Much for Healthcare. He's also, full disclosure, been an expert for PBMs in a number of court cases. Within our convoluted healthcare system, David says that PBMs are fulfilling an important function, although he admits it's often a controversial one.
Somebody has to administer the pharmacy benefits for both public and private entities, right? They have to decide what we're going to cover and how much we're going to pay for it and where we're going to pay that, then handle the, you know, millions of transactions that result once you've decided to provide pharmacy benefits as part of your health insurance coverage. PBMs actually got spun out of insurance companies or started on their own offering services to insurance companies and to employers, and then they became important when the Medicare Part D benefit got set up as people who were administering the benefit more or less as well. And the controversial aspect of their business is the extent to which those rebates are passed back to the plan sponsor, but also the extent to which the copayment that the patient pays is tied to the list price of the drug or the post-rebate price of the drug. And that's been sort of persistent pain point that's attracted lots of attention. The other thing that's attracted lots of attention is Not surprisingly, middlemen try to buy low and sell high.
Now, PBMs have a lot of pricing power in a market where, as we discussed earlier, the prices are pretty arbitrary. The three largest PBMs collectively oversee prescriptions for more than 200 million Americans through private and government-run insurance. A big New York Times investigation last year found that they, quote, steer patients towards pricier drugs, allowing them to charge steep markups on what would otherwise be inexpensive medicines and extract billions of dollars in hidden fees. Additionally, PBM executives have been dressed down in committee hearings, like this one, where Representative Jake Auchincloss, a Democrat from Massachusetts, quizzed a few of them.
I decided to do my own investigation in Massachusetts, and this data here is not anecdotal. This is CVS's own data for an employer based in Massachusetts. I'm going to throw out two prices for each drug name, and I want you to guess, Mr. Joyner, which drug is the price CVS charges the employer and which drug is the NADAC price. And I wish that one of the pharmacists in the audience here could help me with these drug names, but we've got teriflunomide, which is used to treat multiple sclerosis. It's priced at $6,229 or $16. Which one do you think is the CVS true cost and which one is NADAC?
If it were the true cost price, it would be the lower.
Well, that's interesting because the answer is the CVS price is $6,229 and NADAC is $16. That is a 38,000% markup.
Yeah. Auchincloss has introduced a bipartisan bill that would regulate how much money pharmacies make in reimbursement deals with PBMs and that would limit their ability to steer patients towards certain pharmacies. David says that even though the bill is presented as an attempt to lower costs, this is really just a fight over who gets the bigger cut, the PBMs or the pharmacies. It's similar to laws that have passed in a number of states already.
The often, you know, framing of this is, well, individual patients benefit or don't benefit. But if you look at the details of the legislation at the state level, it's pretty much invariably framed around what's good for the independent pharmacies. So it's, you know, it's an old story, right? They're posturing as if they're serving the public benefit when they're not.
And it's not just Congress getting involved. Earlier this year, news leaked that the Federal Trade Commission is preparing to sue the big three PBMs. That's United Health Group's OptumRx, CVS Health's Caremark, and Cigna's Express Scripts. It's too soon to say what's going to come out of that, but given the FTC's recent interest in antitrust action, it seems likely that the commission is going to be focused on how these PBMs work to limit competition and control prices. Rather than waiting for the government to try to fix this, Mark says that it's a problem employers could step up to try to solve.
What I've started to do is go out to CEOs, whether it's nonprofit, whether it's any type of company, and say, it's time for you to make this a core competency in your business. Your healthcare expenses are your second largest line item after payroll. And so I understand that you're just trying to run the company and that's your core competency, but it's so expensive. You either need to have a healthcare CEO that you focus on full time, or you need to start auditing and understanding what you're doing, because I don't care how big you are, 10,000, 100,000, a million employees, you are getting ripped off.
And it's the lack of price signals, the lack of transparency that makes all of that possible.
Exactly. Like if it were up to me, I'm not looking for legislation. No, that's not even necessary. Like I've talked to multiple governors and I've talked to people like Bernie Sanders and he's like, Mark, we need to do something. The big pharma is ripping us off. And I'm like, no, Bernie, it's the PBMs that are ripping you off. And if you want to change all this immediately, and I've said this with gut to governors, to Bernie, to other senators, require every contract with any healthcare provider in your state to be published with every single number.
I guess the goal is to go from just generalized frustration at drug prices to actually knowing, having a more specific frustration at why, like understanding why the price
is what it is. Actually, if we can bring transparency, if I can get employers and government agencies and nonprofits like yourselves to act in their own best interest, we don't need any help from the government, because then they'll only do transparent contracts.
I think there's something quite compelling about this idea. Government has made a mess of healthcare in a bunch of ways, so more entrepreneurialism, fewer middlemen, and more on-demand delivery services, like cost-plus drugs, All of that seems like a way to steer us in a much better direction. But there's one other problem that we need to talk about. Let's call it the $10 banana problem. As a nod to that famous moment from the TV show Arrested Development, which has lived on in internet culture.
Don't you judge me. You're the selfish one. You're the one who charged his own brother for a Bluth frozen banana. I mean, it's one banana, Michael. What could it cost? $10?
You've never actually set foot in a supermarket, have you?
I don't have time for that.
Okay, so even if you've never seen the show, the context here is pretty easy to pick up. The joke isn't much more complicated than the fact that Jessica Walters' character thinks bananas cost 10 bucks because she's really rich and out of touch. But you're not really rich and out of touch. If you went to the grocery store and tried to buy a single banana and it rang up as $10, I know, we should make a joke about inflation here. But no, I mean, you'd know something was wrong. You wouldn't pay $10 for a banana. The bigger point is that as consumers, we don't have to have perfect knowledge of an economy to participate in the market. You probably have no idea what a worker on a banana farm is paid. You don't know how much the wholesaler might have paid to buy those bananas or how many middlemen were involved between the farm and the store. In fact, you might not even know what the average price of a banana in the United States is at this moment. We looked it up. It's about 63 cents per pound. So a $10 banana would be more than a 1,500% markup. And you'd never agree to pay that price because you only have so much money and you can't be wasting it on expensive bananas when there are much cheaper bananas available elsewhere and lots of other things worth buying with your money. Ah, but what if you weren't using your own money? Would that change things?
So in the United States, 90% of health spending comes from someone other than the patient. It comes from the government, when only 10% of the spending is coming from the consumer. The consumer has almost no incentive to shop around for lower prices because 90% of the savings isn't going to come to me. It's going to go to you. And I don't want to, you know, exert all that effort just to save you money.
This is Michael Cannon. He's the director of health policy studies at the Cato Institute and the author of Recovery, a guide to reforming the U.S. health sector. More recently, he's also contributed a chapter to a book titled The War on Prices, an appropriate theme for our conversation today.
So any economic system, whether it's capitalism or communism or socialism or mercantilism, whatever, every economic system serves the people who control the money. And in the United States, people spend about $4 trillion on healthcare, but the wrong people control that $4 trillion. The government controls it because of the government. Employers control another huge chunk of it. And the people that the health sector is supposed to serve control very little of it, and less than in most advanced nations. And as a result, we get a health sector that doesn't serve the needs of consumers and patients. We get a health sector that serves the needs of employers and of the government and whoever controls the government, which ends up being the healthcare industry.
Price transparency, in short, might not matter as much if the consumer isn't paying. That's probably why Cuban is so keen on getting employers and the government to pay more attention to the savings that are available from cost-plus drugs. It also suggests that price transparency alone isn't going to change consumers' habits in the healthcare market the way it might in a different market, like at a grocery store.
You can show them the prices, but they're not going to care unless it's their money on the line. So price transparency mandates, those are meaningless. They're a waste of time because, yeah, you can force producers to disclose the prices. And if they are the real prices, often they're not. But even if they are the real prices, if I'm not spending my own money, I don't care. I have so many more things to worry about than the prices of items that it's, you know, that I'm not purchasing with my money, that I'm purchasing with your money.
Remember that Vanderbilt study I talked about earlier? The one that said taxpayers could save up to $2 billion per year if insurers operating the Medicare prescription drug plans purchased 7 generic oncology drugs at the same prices obtained by cost plus drugs? That's a huge amount of savings, $2 billion a year. But if the government takes advantage of those savings, somebody else is losing. And that's the special interests in the healthcare industry.
Here is an indication of just how not a free market the U.S. health sector is and whom the health sector ends up serving. Congress requires lobbyists to report their expenditure, their lobbying expenditures. So if you're a defense industry lobbyist, you have to report, you have to register with Congress and you have to report to Congress how much money you're spending to lobby Congress on defense issues. U.S. military is a very large enterprise. Maybe you're familiar with their work. You would think that the defense industry might spend the most lobbying Congress of all sectors of the economy. The defense industry might have the highest expenditure on.
And it has the biggest incentive since Congress is literally paying. It's the only Congress buyer.
It's a huge socialized enterprise. And yet, the health sector of the economy spends almost six times as much lobbying Congress as the entire defense industry. All the people who make all the aircraft carriers and guns and missiles and all that, they spend about one-sixth of what the health sector spends. The pharmaceutical industry, all by itself, spends about three times as much as the defense industry on lobbying Congress. That is both an indication of how not a free market we have, because in a free market, the government wouldn't have any control over the health sector. There'd be no reason, no levers of power for the industry to try to influence. But the federal government controls so much of the health sector that the healthcare industry finds it in their interest to spend almost a billion dollars each year lobbying Congress so that they can get higher prices out of Medicare, so that they can preserve the tax preferences or expand the tax preferences for healthcare and on down the line. And it also shows you who the government ends up serving, who all those government interventions end up serving. They don't end up serving patients or consumers. They end up protecting the high-cost, low-quality providers who would never survive in a market.
I feel like I should apologize a little bit for ending this on kind of a downer note. But then again, this is a show called Why We Can't Have Nice Things. To go back to the banana analogy for just a moment, imagine that you had to buy bananas through a program that operates like Medicare's prescription drug benefit. So you've got an insurance plan that is heavily subsidized by the government, and that means you don't really know or care what bananas cost when you go to the store. You get charged $10 by the clerk, but you only pay $1 out of pocket and the government covers the rest. That $10 doesn't actually go to the store. It goes to your banana insurance company, and they've negotiated with a third party, a BBN, a banana benefits manager, to set a different price with the store, and then those guys work out those transactions on the side. Meanwhile, the store has to work out deals with the banana farmers and the rest of the supply chain, but since all of that is pretty disconnected from the demand for bananas, the farmers might just decide to raise their prices one day, maybe by a lot, just because they feel like it, or maybe because Martin Shkreli bought the farm. And meanwhile, everyone involved, well, everyone except you, is lobbying the government to put more restrictions on every other facet of the process, or to change the way the subsidies get distributed. What would a banana cost in that situation? $10? $1? Would anyone know? And then over on the side, you've got Mark Cuban shouting, "Hey, if you buy bananas from me, I'll get them direct from the farmers and ship them to your house, and you can skip all of that insanity, and it'll cost a lot less." That's awesome, and you might shop there. It's not going to solve the whole problem, but hey, it's a lot better than the status quo.
If you want to make healthcare more universal, then market prices and this system of free-floating prices that reflect underlying costs and consumer preferences rather than, you know, political imperatives is essential, because that is the process that drives prices down, and that's how we make everything more universal. That is how we have made food so universal that we're keeping 8 billion people alive right now. It wasn't government price setting that delivered that. It wasn't government subsidies, food subsidies, that's keeping 8 billion people alive. It's improvements in the production and distribution of food, innovations in those areas, and expanded or freer trade that has driven food prices down. Market prices have been an essential part of that, and we need to use the same process to make healthcare more universal.
I'm Eric Boehm, and that seems like a good place to wrap up this first episode of our new season. We've ended here with a kind of a big picture critique of what's wrong with American healthcare, and over the next few weeks, we'll be drilling down into some of the specific laws and regulations and political dynamics that make the healthcare system so expensive and frustrating. Join me next week for part one of a two-part story about a pair of healthcare entrepreneurs. They've tried to react to obvious needs within their communities only to be shut down by state laws that effectively let hospitals limit competition.
So you're saying that a McDonald's can't open next to a Burger King, is what you're essentially saying, is you can't have two competing businesses in the healthcare market.
I hope you'll join me for that story next Thursday. Special thanks to my guests on this episode, especially Mark Cuban, the co-founder of Cost Plus Drugs. Go to costplusdrugs.com to learn more and maybe save yourself a bunch of money in the process. Also, thanks to Michael Cannon from the Cato Institute. Find his work online at cato.org and also check out his latest book, Recovery, A Guide to Reforming the U.S. Health Sector. And thanks to David Hyman from Georgetown University Law Center. Check out his book, Overcharged, Why Americans Pay Too Much for Healthcare. It is a fantastic, detailed account of the many, many problems with the healthcare industry. And honestly, I could not have tackled this show without it. So check out that book as well. This week's episode was written by Eric Boehm and produced by Hunt Beatty. Our executive editor at Reason is Jim Epstein. Fact-checking by Anthony Wallace. Subscribe to Why We Can't Have Nice Things in our podcast feed to get new episodes every week. And check out the previous episodes from last year. The first season is up there. You can go back and listen to them while you're waiting for the new ones to drop. We'll catch you next week.
Given the way the healthcare industry works right now, could you have started Cost Plus Drugs if you weren't like a billionaire and wildly successful to begin with? Could somebody come in off the street with an idea and do this?
No chance. It's expensive.
Yeah.
It's expensive, right? And let me just tell you this. I'm going to put a little bit of my own personal political spin in this. But if there was a wealth tax where I had to withhold, like I had to hold back a lot of cash just in case the stock market went up and I had to pay my 2%, I couldn't do this. Right. Because
you're talking about like a tax on unrealized gains. That
yeah, tax on unrealized gains, tax on net worth, because you don't know what it's going to be. And you don't know, you know, if you ever get a rebate, if it goes down again. And so you have to retain a lot of, you know, it's a good problem to have. I'm not complaining. Right. All I'm saying is in terms of fungible cash to invest in things that matter, I couldn't have done it if there was a tax on unrealized capital gains or net worth.